Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Startopia Radio.
Welcome to Startopia Radio. I'm Michael Lauer, and we've got a great show lined up for you guys today. Later on, we'll be visiting with the one and only Tommy Cunningham. But first, we have Frederick Weston from Sensio Tech. Is that right?
That's correct.
I totally butchered that, but it's Sensio Tech, right?
Sensio Tech, correct.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about Sensio Tech and what you're doing for people.
So we have developed the world's first completely non-contact patient monitoring system. So we basically use radar to collect patient information like heart rate and respiration. And we can also do that wirelessly, collect patient presence in the bed and if the patient is about to exit the bed.
So it's kind of like a human body NFC kind of thing, right?
It is.
So that's a pretty groundbreaking kind of stuff, though. I mean, if you can measure a patient without having to hook it up, and you're taking some human error out of that, right?
We do, and we're also cutting a lot of cost out of the system by doing it wirelessly because you get continuous monitoring for these patients where conventional systems either give you intermittent monitoring or you have to take those vitals manually, which is both cost takes a lot of time.
Time,
and it's costly.
Yeah. And then it cuts down some training too, because now people don't have to learn that. I mean, they probably still should, but it's you're taking a lot of, like you said, costs out of the equation.
Correct.
So you guys have created this solution. Is this all you guys do? Is this this technology, or do you have other things that you guys are working on, or other missions and purpose?
Well, the company, it's today we're launching the virtual medical assistant, which basically takes the vitals. But the technology is a platform technology, so it can be applied in many different areas. But we're going to market with, this product towards hospitals as a first step.
So you're launching it today, so this isn't out yet?
Well, it is out.
It's out?
Yeah, it is out.
And how's the reception of it?
It's really, when we talk to hospital administrators, they get blown away. They get really interested in the whole concept.
So, yeah, well, it's totally revolutionary. So what is your role with Sensio Tech?
I'm the president of the company.
So you are the grand poobah.
Well, so I report to the CEO, who's the grand poobah.
Gotcha.
But I'm making sure that, we're aligned with our goals and making things happen.
It's pretty big responsibility.
It is.
But you made it happen. You got to work. And I do have some questions about the actual product, actually. So when a nurse walks in, does that interfere with the readings? How does it know who to lock onto?
No. So what happens, the panel slides in under the mattress of the patient, and it's very directional. So like the microphones we're using right now,
sure.
It collects the data just on top of the panel itself.
Wow. So it's in the bed?
It's under the mattress in the bed, but it's not touching the patient.
Now, are you selling the bed, or are you selling the thing that goes in the bed?
The thing that goes in the bed.
Oh, so this works for any bed, really?
It would.
So it could work for a home patient.
One of the, I would say, future developments would be to go into the home setting with a panel, because as healthcare is getting more and more expensive and having people in the hospital or in hospital-like settings with patients, it's very expensive. So more and more monitoring is going to happen from the home, and this is a system that would allow that transition to happen faster.
So we're finding that a lot of things have unintentional side effects. Like my phone now apparently is giving me cancer right now.
Yeah.
As we speak,
yeah.
I'm getting cancer from my iPhone. Is that something that's maybe a concern with this radar? I mean, these people are already sick.
No, I think that's an excellent question, because when we talk about the system, that's one of the more common questions. And I'm glad that you brought up the comparison with the phone, because if you look at the signal strength from the panel compared to the signal strength of a cell phone, a cell phone is 50 million times stronger in terms of signal strength.
That's a lot.
So
it's a lot stronger.
Yeah, we're barely detected, and we also have FDA clearance, which means that the FDA already looked at the device, whether or not it's safe for the patient, and they deemed it to be safe.
Well, I want to ask more questions about Sensio Tech, but I know later on in the show we want to kind of have a discussion more about healthcare changes. So real quick, how would you feel about hanging out with us when we visit with our next guest?
Happy to do that.
All right, so just to introduce Tommy a little bit here, you were with CCB Research Group, correct?
Yes.
So explain a little bit about what you guys are doing in your role with the company.
So we're a medical device startup company. We're developing infant technology. Essentially,
and that's N-F-A-N-T,
N-F-A-N-T.
Right?
I've never been the best speller, left off the I, but a little Freudian slip there.
Sure.
What we're doing is making any bottle or pacifier nipple a smart bottle or pacifier nipple, and measuring the strength of an infant's tongue and how they're feeding, their coordination for feeding, in hopes of getting them out of the neonatal intensive care unit faster.
So you're getting personalized data in a different way. So why is it important to get it through feeding strength?
So to feed, you have to have a strong tongue. So the tongue drives everything. So if you have a weak tongue, you aren't able to throw the food back, trigger a reflex, and swallow. So when infants try to switch from tube feeding to bottle feeding in the neonatal intensive care unit, it's a bottleneck effect. There's a lot of trouble that happens right there.
Well, they got to learn this skill. They haven't already had a chance to use it.
They haven't had
atrophy now. You have to retrain your body, right?
Right. So with a feeding tube, there's a lot going on with these infants in the hospital. They've just survived a surgery, and it's a very stressful environment. There's a lot to conquer. Well, with a feeding tube, they're going to grow bigger and stronger and gain weight because they need to. Unfortunately, they're not using their tongue. So when you don't use your tongue, it becomes weaker. So even though they're getting older and they're getting heavier, their tongue might be lagging behind, and that's going to create a cascade of effects for the infant.
Yeah, and when they get off the tube, they're going to get smaller again, and you may have some health issues with that, right?
Right, and that's called failure to thrive. So that's more of a term that parents, it's their worst nightmare to take a kid home and then they're not gaining weight. It's panic
mode. Or losing weight.
They're losing weight. They have to go back in. So there's the neonatal aspect of, yes, we need to get this infant home as fast as we possibly can. You have to be able to feed to go home. But even if they're home or even if you're born on time, 10% of all infants get sent back to the hospital for failure to thrive. We think we can step in there and assess their feeding ability as well.
So this product just assess, or does it also help with some training as well, kind of get them their strength back up?
So right now we're focusing on diagnosing and giving the clinician and the healthcare team that information they need to make better assessments. Because if they don't assess the kid correctly, or if they delay a feeding or they introduce a feeding too early, you can have some consequences, apnea, bradycardia. So not being able to breathe, feeling the sensations of drowning for these infants, that derails those infants. So just having more information so those clinicians can make a better decision, that's where we're focusing on. But I think knowledge is power. So if you're empowering the clinician, they're making decisions. The infants are feeding under a safer environment, a more controlled environment. They will get better just with that information.
We're not guessing anymore, right?
Right.
That's a big
guessing
thing.
Is bad. Yeah. As a scientist, I like to know information.
I said guess, and no one can see, but he kind of tensed up when you're at home. You can't really see his chest get tight all of a sudden.
Yeah, I like objective data. I'm kind of a data nerd, but disseminating that data, and it goes back into our mobile app black box, and then we can put it out in information that physicians want, a green or a red, a 1 through a 10,
sure.
Not all this complicated stuff that happens in the background. Make their jobs easier.
Right. So how did you guys establish a baseline? What's normal? What's acceptable in order for tongue strength, in order to be able to swallow and trigger that reflex? I mean, that takes time and a little bit of discernment to kind of figure out when you have a correct baseline.
Right. And we are the company and the research group that establish that baseline, and we're looking into that. This is an incredibly new concept. It is as intuitive as it sounds. The train of thought in the medical world's always been that these infants are uncoordinated and they can't feed. They don't know how to feed. We stepped in and said, you can't even know how to feed unless you have the utilities or the tongue strength to feed. So we ran a clinical trial and tested that. It was a brand new theory, and what we found could fundamentally shift how we view all infant feeding disorders. And that's, what are those thresholds? And that's what we're looking at right now.
You must have had a lot of backlash when you were flipping the script on people, right? What was that like?
You gotta be a nice guy. Smile, help them out. Make
it for the kids.
Absolutely. Who doesn't like kids?
That's right. But right. I mean, seriously, how do you deal with someone who's telling you, what do you know? I mean, this is how we've been doing it for years.
No, you get that. You get that. There's nobody wants to be wrong in anything. So the goal is to help them out. The patient is first, helping the patient and family. So as long as we can agree to that, we can move forward. And then it comes with the technology, is making it as simple as you can, making it as cost effective as you can, lowering the barriers of to market entry So say, I know this is brand new. It's non-invasive. It's safe. We have IRBs and clinical IRBs. A lot of people that sit around and say, is this very safe? Is non-significant risk? Yes, yes, yes. Just try it out. Tell me if you like it. And then we can show you how we're helping your patients and getting them better. And it's a process. But when we were able to take our pacifier and bottle and it displayed on a mobile device and crowds gathered around in the hospital, then we knew we were onto something pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys are. And it sounds like you guys are really progressing kind of fast. So tell me a little bit about where the company's heading in the future.
Right. So I always like looking to the future. I always deal with the present right now. But
do you have any future projects that you're working on, or just pretty much the main one? And if so, in what stages are you in the product, and how much further do you have to go before it's in, you know, next to Frederick's radar?
We are in a Series A fundraise right now. So we're raising money to get through the last hurdle of FDA approval. But we are doing that in an accelerated time frame. So what takes a typical medical device company maybe 5 to 6 years, we've been able to do in about a year. Absolutely hitting everything in stride and doing the right things. It pays to be a winner. And we designed a device that we were able to to get in the hands of clinicians and improve very rapidly. We just brought on a CEO on Wednesday, Lou Malice, just a industry veteran, has been doing this time and time again. Just proven success in getting those medical devices to the commercial stage where a lot fall by the wayside. We're very confident that we'll be able to take this device that's in the hands of a few physicians right now and be able to scale that and get those into as many hospitals as we can. So we have our focus and our blinders are on infant technology, this specific aspect, working on the neonatal intensive care unit market, and then expanding from there. It's a natural expansion to other infants from there.
Now, Frederick, you've already gone through this process when trying to get your product FDA approved. Can you speak to the challenges that you know, Tommy's having right now? Maybe some advice you can give him when getting through the Series A funding acquisition?
Well, so to put it in context, we, as a company, we went through to get a FDA-cleared device to the tune of $5 million, where the average cost of getting a medical device through FDA clearance is $31 million. So
well, how much are you having to get?
I did it, or I'm going to do it with $300,000.
Yeah, so you see, you know, by doing it correctly and doing it the right way and having a technology that lends itself to be, expedited through the system, it's going to be tremendously helpful. And going through FDA is a huge hurdle, and when it comes to the investment community, that's what they're looking at, and it affects your valuation tremendously when you have that approval.
Well, and typically, they want more than they want a return on that investment, right? They want to know it's going to do well and how. So it speaks, knowing that you didn't have to raise as much, it speaks to the effectiveness and the demand of your products, right?
To a certain degree, it does, yes.
So what factors go into keeping that cost low?
I think by bootstrapping, if you have too much money in the early days, I think people blow it on things that they don't have to blow it on. So by having a tight budget, you have to make tough choices, and you have to keep timelines, because every day in a startup company is costing you money. So being smart on how you're deploying your money is key.
Now, I want to open this up and kind of talk to both of you about how healthcare has been changing. And before I do that, it's brought to my attention that you guys have worked together in the past.
Yeah, we Frederick and I go way back.
Way back, like Sandbox? Like back to the Sandbox, building castles, stuff like that? Or
no,
I don't think they play baseball in Sweden.
No, we don't. We all play soccer.
Soccer?
That's the
football.
One game.
The World Cup's coming up.
Yeah,
it is.
No, but really, what did you guys work on in the past, and how has that relationship evolved over the years?
So Tom and I worked in a company called ERMI, End Range of Motion Improvement, and we did rehab equipment. And Tommy was hired out of University of Kentucky as one of our research engineers, doing a lot of, I would say, interesting things around knee evaluations and robotics that we developed in the company. And at that time, I was the president of ERMI.
So you guys didn't necessarily work directly together, but you hired him.
Yeah, so we did work directly together, but he was on more on the research side, and I was more on the side that was at the time bringing in the money.
Sure. And about how long ago was this?
2 years back?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So it was pretty recent. Yeah. It wasn't as far back as I was thinking. So how has the healthcare changed in 2 years, but let alone 10 years? I mean, how's the whole industry changed, you know, with legislation and demand and all that stuff?
I think one of the main thing that is happening right now is that everyone is trying to cut cost. So it comes from...
And that's different from the past 10 years? People weren't worried about cost then?
No, I think it's always been a push towards cutting costs. But when you look at what's happening in the insurance community and what's happening from the federal government, there's a lot of pressure to bring costs down. Because now we have an aging population and we have fewer caregivers to take care of that aging population. And not only do we have a growing number of older people, they're getting older and older with more complex disease states, if you will.
Sure.
So everyone is looking at cutting costs. So that means that if you have a device where you are looking at getting reimbursement through either Medicare, Medicaid, or through regular insurance, that's going to be increasingly hard for you. And if you have something that will actually cut cost for the system, you can still make it and be a thriving company. Otherwise, it's going to be tough going forward.
So now it's not only making a product, it's making a product that does things maybe more efficiently than an older product, right?
Yeah.
Well, expanding on what Frederick was saying, is there's about three major factors. One, you have to be better for the patient. You can't just have a little small improvement. Two, you have to drive down costs. And you have to be able to prove it. You know, you have to be able to do
this. Can't be a theoretical kind of thing.
No,
you gotta have the research, right?
No more smoke and mirrors.
Right.
Evidence-based practice of medicine. I welcome that. Having a smart technology, we can collect information and data, and we're using technologies that are commodities and everything. So a cell phone uses everything that we're using. There's 4 billion cell phones.
Right.
Why can't I just make a medical device smart and have it talk to the cell phone that a physician or a nurse carries around in their pocket?
Already, right.
Right. So when you do that and you can implement that, you know, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, it says you have to be better, but we're only going to pay you is if you're driving down costs and you have evidence-based practice of medicine. I'm for that. I'm raising my hand saying, cool, my competitors can't do it. We can offer a product that's 250,000% less costly than the next best thing out there. That drives down costs. That helps the system out. And when you can turn around and prove that with the information and the data you're collecting, you'll be implemented. And we look forward to that.
And you're finding that this challenge, you said your competitors aren't necessarily doing it because they've been kind of riding the wave maybe a little bit too much?
I think you've just in the last few years. I mean, the introduction of the iPad was 2008.
Right.
That hasn't. I mean, that's an eternity in the medical device world, or in the technology world. Medical device world probably lags, you know, 10 to 15 years behind, you know, any curve for that. It's a large system. It's hard to be implemented into
sure.
a system. But if we're utilizing this technology, the physicians are becoming more used to, you know, checking their tablet or their phone or wanting that information right there or store that information for a lookup later. They're becoming more accustomed to that.
Well, yeah, which just makes sense to give them the information the way they're already getting information on their own, right? I mean, that's kind of that's the trend now, is everything has to be mobile, everything has to be accessible by what's already in my pocket and by using this technology that's already created and having it maybe do some of the thinking for you.
Well, doctors, they're some of the smartest people I work with. They know
right.
their stuff. But nobody wants to be on an island. They want to talk to their colleagues. They want to know how their patients are doing. They want to know how their patients are doing compared to other patients. They're very competitive individuals. They want to be the best. Well, if we can provide that information from hospital to hospital or just within that same hospital comparing their patients, their metrics, we leverage that to produce better care over the long term. And everybody's for that.
Now, how do you get from because it's a fine line between being a useful product and just another bell and whistle. How do you keep yourself from becoming just another cool thing instead of something that just needs to be done and integrated and makes sense?
I think that is something that the market decides for you, because if you don't have anything that makes a difference, nobody's going to really gravitate towards you. And in the startup world, if you have something that is truly unique, you're getting investors attracted to it. If you don't, nobody's going to invest in you. You're going to go away.
So I want to go back a little further here and kind of get some more background information on each of you. So tell me about how you started in the medical industry and kind of what brought you to your products now and your companies now. So Frederick, we'll start with you.
So early on, I was working in pharma in Sweden. And at a time, I was global product manager for the product manager in Sweden is really the correct term for all the pain medications and cold remedies for AstraZeneca. And I was kind of wanting to do something different. I wanted to go into consumer products. I thought pharmaceuticals was kind of limiting. So I worked for Ericsson, the phone manufacturer, as a global product manager for a couple of years. And at that time, I got an opportunity to start working with ERMI and range of motion improvement here in the U.S., and I moved my family to do that. And that gave me sort of an insight into the medical device space in the U.S., and I worked for that company for 12 years, and 10 of those years as president.
Is the medical space different in Europe as opposed to here as far as, you know, devices and what's gets approved, what doesn't, and what takes and what doesn't, that kind of stuff?
I would say that it's probably equally hard to get something approved, but when it comes to the payer community, it's very often the government paying for everything. So instead of having private insurance companies footing the bill, it's you pay the bill through your taxes, which makes it very different. But it's also a way to hold down medical costs. So if you look at what it costs to treat an individual, let's say in an average European country, to treating that same patient in the U.S., it's multiple times more expensive here in the U.S.
And that's because of the healthcare system, the way the multiple pay system, or what are some factors in that?
Well, there's really
this is changing.
It is changing, but you know, it's a system where you know nobody really knows how much things cost. So
right,
at the end
like,
of the day,
this is how much it costs. Yeah. They kind of just throw out a number because they think they can get it, right?
And you can't get a number up front if you're going to have surgery. How much it's going to cost, you know, we'll see down the road. And it's going to be different.
Why is that? It seems like, you know, when I buy food, the prices are there, right? And I know how much I'm going to spend before I get done. So why is that necessarily?
I think that's the $1 million question. Because
so if I answer it, I get $1 million.
Well,
it's a $100 billion question.
It's a much bigger question.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, so if I have surgery and Tommy has surgery and the same type surgery is going to cost us differently, and nobody really can explain why that is.
Same doctor, same hospital, same anesthesia, same thing all the way around.
Yeah.
And I guess it would depend if you had different, you know, provider as well. Is that why maybe they negotiate?
It's partly, you know, it's also negotiated what kind of contracts do the insurance provider have with that hospital system, for instance.
And Tommy? Give me a little background on you. Now, you have a PhD.
I do. I'm smarter than I look sometimes, I guess. I have an engineering background.
Okay.
I was...
From Kentucky, I've heard.
From Kentucky, yeah. Lexington, Kentucky, at the University of Kentucky. I was kind of a lifer there. I spent 10 years going from an undergrad engineer all the way to a PhD in biomechanics. And I was set to, you know, go work in industry and whatnot, not in the medical field. But I just couldn't, I wanted to like help people out, and I was trying to figure out my path, and a mentor of mine, Tim Uhl, took me under his wing, taught me about the musculoskeletal system, how the body works, how to measure the body, and I was the token engineer, the only engineer in the College of Health Sciences there, so people just kept, clinicians and researchers would come up to me and say, hey, I've got this idea, and they didn't know you could actually build some of this stuff or design it, so I kind of stepped in, started a company. To do that on the side. They don't pay graduate students as they should,
right?
Just to make ends meet. And so I hit a few singles with that, about 10 to 12 different projects under budget, on time, all the time, and was really introduced to a lot of cool technologies and had
innovation
to do it
too, right? I mean,
yeah, just it was really cool to see what happens, you know, in a specific disease or with research, and so really exposed to a lot of things, but in academia the budgets aren't really there, so you have to do it low cost, and so you kind of got good at bootstrapping, so to speak, and communicating with clinicians. So the last clinician that came to me was my eventual co-founder, Dr. Gilson Capiluto, and she said, I need a bottle and a pacifier to measure the strength of the tongue. It's like, cool, I need a weekend and a bottle of wine. And then we were off to the races. And But then I ended up, you know, that was in the middle of my PhD. And word of advice for those out there working on it, don't start a company while trying to write a dissertation. It's not a recipe to finish with a land speed record by any means. But then Frederick sniped me and brought me down to Atlanta. Wanted to know what this kid up in Kentucky was doing. And so I wrote a dissertation while working for him. And then I jumped ship to start this company.
So growing up, or not growing up, but starting out in the education field and doing things for the university system kind of taught you how to cut costs. And in this growing trend now for healthcare, I mean, that kind of prepared you for this, right? Speak to the kind of challenges and the similarities.
I think with academia, that's a lot of the thoughts and the brain power are in academia. The timelines and the budgets aren't there. So it is longer timelines to everything. And you're reliant on grants. I'm an entrepreneur at heart, a capitalist, you name it. But I love the thought process and sitting at a round table and figuring out the best way to go about something. But I can raise more money in a day than I could write. It would take me 6 months to write a NIH grant. I don't have the patience for that.
Right.
So it's forming a company around an idea or a technology, securing intellectual property. Universities do that, and some do it better than others, and some don't. But taking a company perspective to it. So I'm an adjunct faculty at Kentucky, but it's more of linking the private sector and the public sector together. It's, okay, we can do some cool research with you guys. I'll go raise money to do it, but there has to be a product behind it. We have to become self-sustainable, opposed to relying on grants. I mean, grant money's drying up. As an entrepreneur, I can't rely on that.
Can't count on that.
It could be the best idea, but if you didn't articulate it well, or if you spelled something wrong in 12 pages, you didn't get, you know, the grant. I'm not going to rely on that. I'm going to go rely on building a business model, bringing people involved that are good at getting that product in the hands, and investors step in with that.
Now, is it becoming easier to do that with the changes in the healthcare system, or harder, or speak to the kind of maybe different challenges that are coming about from having to have a product that cuts cost and the way that you can bootstrap a product through to finish?
Well, I think it's atypical to bootstrap a product, and it's not as fun as you would think. You know, I would I take the money up front, but if do it all again,
is that same for you, Fred? You're laughing over here. Is the same for you?
No, I think the struggle for any startup company coming up with cool technology is that you always look for money. All the time.
Scrounging all the time.
Yeah. I think the problem, and you're seeing a little void, and you see it in Atlanta, unfortunately, is that venture capital, private equity, and then angel investors, and then you have like your seed funding. That's kind of typical in fundraising. It's many firms in the industry are risk adverse than what they used to be maybe 10 to 20 years ago, to where venture capitalists, usually it's larger money and you're a little further along. Some are like right at the beginning, but you're further along or generating revenues and they have, okay, we're going to make this much money and then we'll step out again. You're seeing those same, and those come with terms and whatnot. And you're seeing those same terms, but from just your average high net worth individual investor that can afford to invest in a riskier medical device company. Where it's that takes time then to negotiate or hit the streets and say, okay, maybe this deal isn't for you. You know, you're seeing those goalposts shift.
Was it harder to find the individuals now that they're kind of individuals instead of a venture capitalist or something like that? Is it becoming a different focus?
I think it depends. You know, is this your first rodeo?
Right.
Have you been in the industry? How well connected are you to those individuals that can invest in the company? So before, it was always just private fundraising and who do you know and who can you get in a room with and shake their hand and see if it's a deal. With the Jobs Act last year, that's starting to become a little easier to where you can, I wouldn't say advertise your deal, but you can say, hey, I'm raising money, or you don't have to raise it from high net worth individuals. We are only raising from high net worth individuals because we're just accredited investors. So just when we go to VCs or private equity later, they like that.
Right,
so
like
just saying,
track record.
Yeah, just
so like your credit score.
Okay, yeah, we're keeping our credit high right now. As much as it would have been great to raise $5 or $10 here, and you know, you put a video on the internet of you know helping the kids. Yeah, you're going to generate a large response, but in the medical device world, there's a lot of hurdles to cross. And for scale to Europe or scale to the U.S., if it takes off, that's going to require larger revenues to invest into the company or raising additional funds from private equity or venture capitalists. And you don't want to inhibit that just because you were you needed it right then. You know, cooler heads prevail typically in the long run.
So with this growing trend of cutting costs and having technology that continues to cut costs and drive efficiency, how is this changing patient care in general and specifically with each of your products?
So if you look at our radar-based system, you know, I think one way of improving things for the patient is to use something that saves caregivers time. So instead of spending time...
But do I want my doctor spending less time on me?
Well, you want your nurse not to wake you up in the middle of the night to take your readings. And
gotcha.
We did a study where we looked at a 36-bed hospital wing to see, okay, how much time would you put... would it take for a caregiver to monitor those 36 patients per day, taking vitals four times every day? And what we found was that every day you're saving 15 hours of nurse time. And instead of going...
Just for 36 beds.
36 beds, 15 hours. So that's two full-time people. So you can't save those two people and say, hey, I can get rid of two nurses. What happens instead is that you can direct their efforts towards patient care. So maybe that is a phone call to the patient's relatives. Maybe there is a follow-up with another patient where you can spend more time as opposed to doing menial tasks that now is being done automatically.
Well, and you're seeing, the last thing a hospital wants is seeing the news that someone didn't get rolled over and they have bed sores or something like that. I mean, this is giving nurses a chance to free up their time and do things that they actually want to do too, right? I mean, that's what they went to school for, and it gives the patients maybe better care as opposed to quicker care.
Yeah, and one of the things that our system does, so not only do we collect heart rate and respiration, but we can also, if a patient is prone to getting bed sores, we can put in a protocol, what we call a turns protocol. So every 3 hours, the caregiver gets an alert, hey, it's time to turn so-and-so in room 105. Or we can have the system alert the caregiver that the patient hasn't moved over an extended period of time and it's time to go in and move them. And in the hospital setting, the costliest thing that happens in the hospital is patient falling and patient's bed sores. And nobody will reimburse for that. So that's something that the hospital...
Because that's a negligence on the hospital's part, right?
It is. So they actually have to eat that cost. And the highest cost ever for the hospital or on an annual basis is patient falls.
Wow.
And that's something also that our panel takes care of. So
How's it take care of that?
So... we have sensors in the panel that feels whether or not the patient is about to exit the bed. And a lot of patients, especially after surgery, maybe they're on drugs, maybe they might be even be demented, they are not supposed to get out of bed alone. They might not even have the leg strength to do that.
Sure.
So when they do that, they fall and they hit their head, they break their hips. There are a lot of things happening to it. So we can give a caregiver an alert saying that someone in room 105 is actually about to exit the bed. So they can run in and prevent that fall from happening.
That's huge. I mean, those costs, I mean, like you're saying, that they can't get that back. So
no.
In order to save on that, I mean, that's another huge way of cutting costs, right? Not just, you know, making efficiency, but preventing things from happening. And I'm sure you see that a lot also, Tommy, with your product, correct?
Right. And it's, I mean, there's primary, secondary, and tertiary costs. So primary for us, it's, you know, we're saving $2,000 to $6,000 per day per infant. You know, we get them home one day faster. Those are substantial cost savings,
right.
Substantial. And now, you know, these kids right now might get derailed anywhere from 2 to 3 days to 30 days. So that's big time. You know, that's, we can articulate that to the physician or the clinicians and they get that. But now it's what are the secondary costs associated with that's related to what you're doing. So we're solving a specific clinical problem and going towards the root cause. We say the tongue is starting to do everything, the feeding, that starts the feeding issues, which leads to this, you know, $2,000 to $6,000 per day in the hospital. But now they're discharged. What happens to them now? They're not, hospitals aren't going to get reimbursed for the kids coming back, or there's going to be costs at home. So being able to make an economic model or prove that that's happening, you can approach hospital providers and say, look, we had an immediate effect of saving money for you now and getting your patients better, but you also had a reduced amount of infants coming back, or they were healthier, so on. And then that has tertiary effects in the healthcare system. I mean, perfect example for us, it's two things. It's one is related to feeding. We're solving feeding issues. A lot of these infants go home or their tongue is weak and they're not getting trained. They'll develop speech disorders, speech impediments, learning disabilities later on in life. So just making that connection for the healthcare providers and saying, look, we're just doing this one thing and we're going to drive down costs by a few billion if implemented. But now you start escalating
seeing
that
effects,
when they're three
right.
or 4 years old, you see those effects. I mean, you have to think a little bigger with that. But then even going towards effects that aren't related to the infant. In the literature, we found that moms of these preterm infants, they develop post-traumatic stress disorder at alarming rates in the first 5 years after the infant is home. Because it was such a stressful environment in the neonatal intensive care unit, they thought it was their fault. Or, why is my infant not being able to feed? I'm a mom. I need to be able to do that.
Sure.
So you have effects. So then there's healthcare costs associated with this. So if we can go to the root clinical problem, which we feel is the strength of the tongue, as simple as that is, it can have, what's the term, butterfly effect
sure.
in the healthcare world. So.
Well, you touch on a huge point, and that's mental health. And I think, you know, peace of mind is a major part of mental health. And if you've got a product that's, you know, preventing other issues in the future, or it's having an issue resolved sooner, and seeing a definite change and putting numbers on a change, I mean, that's huge for not only the doctors and the nurses, but for the parents. Like you said, that's incredible. I mean, are you finding the same thing with your product? I mean, that's, Frederick, that's giving people – I put my dad in a home, okay, and he is bedridden, and I worry that they're not turning him, or I worry about the care. I mean, now I know that there's this product that available in a nursing home or in a hospital. That gives me some peace of mind.
Yeah, it would, and the way we've developed the product, too, is that we are able to push that information out to any person, any software, any device. So, for instance, let's say your dad were to have one of those systems in the future in the home, and you're worrying, okay, how's my dad doing? Well, you pull up your cell phone and you can see, okay, his heart rate is fine, his respiration is fine too, and he's, you know, fine in bed, you know, and that would give you a tremendous amount of peace of mind.
Right. I'm sure I can set it for alerts too. Say, oh, my dad hasn't been turned in 3 days. What the heck? You know, then I can call, you know, so it gives an accountability for the doctors and the nurses as well, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, having visibility to what's happening to a patient is good for everyone because it keeps everyone on their toes. So we, you know, you can't skimp. You can't say, oh, I did something, you know, if you didn't do it, because here everything is recorded.
Well, and better care is always going to be cheaper.
Correct.
Right? If you can provide better care, it's always going to be cheaper.
Yeah, and
in the long run.
If you use intelligent devices, you will drive down cost and you're going to have higher patient satisfaction.
So here on Sotopia Radio, we interview a lot, if not only, startups. So speak to the challenges and some advice that you can give a startup who's just getting started, just trying to figure out how to get money, how to find people to work for them that's like-minded. I mean, there's a whole lot of issues with being a startup that they're just trying to figure out, and maybe they want to save themselves on a few costly mistakes. What's the biggest advice you can give them? We'll start with you, Tommy.
I'd say everybody tries to protect their idea, or they don't want to tell anybody, or they think, okay, you know, somebody will take my idea. Everybody's way too busy to take your idea. You have to have some precautions or whatnot, but you want to vet that idea. You don't want to go all in on something that, you know, the market might not accept, or there's a lot of things they haven't thought of. So having that plan together, kind of plotting a 1 or 2 year trajectory for yourself, and say, okay, you know, this is going to be a hard process. You're going to be working 80 hours a week doing this. What are your personal funds? What other commitments do you have involved? Can you work a 9-to-5 and do this on the side, or do you have to go all in, so to speak? But who do you have with you? Who have you surrounded yourself with that where you can get advice?
Well, that's a huge part of the problem too. Is that they want to find someone that's dependable and someone that they can trust and maybe share the passion. how do you find that person and keep them?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what you're trying to do. But yes, there are individuals that want to get involved with something or do the startup scene. And, you know, that you want to work it out. It's, okay, you form a company and you decide, okay, what are you going to do and what are you going to do and formalize it and just say, okay, let's try this out for 3 months and let's see how it goes. And if we still have a product and we still like each other.
Right. You haven't killed one or the other yet.
Absolutely. So, you know, keeping consistent with that and saying, cool, I think we're onto something. Now, okay, let's. You need capital. You definitely need capital to progress a company if you can get to revenues and get revenues as soon as you can. But you want advice from people who have done it and people that and Atlanta is a good place for that. There's a lot of advice here and a lot of experience. But then, you know, gearing up to always know you are going to go have to raise money or get revenues as fast as you can, because that's what's going to dictate you going the next step and saying, okay, I'm working with my partner. We've been doing it for 3 months. Now, what about the person who isn't as passionate for our business, but just is really good or talented?
Sure.
How are you going to compensate them? You know, not everybody can work for free for a year or two if it takes to see your product to the market.
And Frederick, what advice would you give?
Well, I think, you know, if you venture down, when you talk to students today, I would say a very large group of students say, hey, I want to be associated with a startup. So it's sort of, it's considered somewhat sexy. And
right.
We have a saying in our company that, you know, this is not a job interview, this is a warning. And that's it's exactly what it is, you know, because it's not everyone is cut out to be in a startup, because things change on a daily basis. And if you are not willing to change with the changes that happen around you, you should not be in the startup world. So, and the second point to that is really that you need to surround yourself with a team that has that same mindset. So you want to have, I think, building the team, the startup team, is so crucial. And you want to have doers around you, people that really can make things happen on a very short period of time. So, you know, finding the right team, vetting those people, and making sure that, you know, if you have the wrong person, you don't hang on to them too long, because
hire slow, fire fast kind of thing.
You fire fast, because it's really, you know, it's a liability to you. That payroll comes, you know, twice a month or once a month. And if you have people who are not carrying their weight, you don't want to have them around. You want to find people who are willing to, you know, run for you and run for you fast.
Well, where can folks go to learn more about Sensio Tech?
So you can go to our website, sensiotech.com. We're also going to be shown. We're one of the Hive companies for the upcoming TEDMED. So we are, you know, out of 500-plus companies thinking that they have, you know, innovative technology, we were one of the companies selected. So
that's
in
awesome.
September, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be at the Hive and possibly also with a podium presentation.
And tell me, where can folks go learn more about your research company and Infin as well?
You can go to our website, ccbresearchgroup.com, and you can always find me on the streets of Atlanta making this happen. So you'll be seeing a lot more of me.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on the show, guys. I'm happy to have you.
Thank you very much for having us.
All right. This is Michael Lauer. This is Startopia Radio. We'll catch you next time.